For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she, too, can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist. Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer from Long Form. Hey, guys.
It's a beautiful day here in Dumbo. This podcast is just rolling on with the smoothness.
Wow, I feel great about the way you described that.
I was excited about your guest this week.
Oh, me too. I talked to Gabriel Sherman of New York Magazine. He's been in the news a lot, not just from his writing, but from him getting wrapped up in the story itself. Gabriel wrote a book about Roger Ailes of Fox News. He's covered the media for a long time for New York, for GQ, for a lot of other publications. And as it happens, Roger Ailes is no longer at Fox News, where he previously was, due to extensive sexual harassment accusations. And in fact, actually, this has happened since we taped this. Gabriel Sherman, there's some reporting indicating that Ailes wanted to have him beat up, or said, can't we just send some guys to beat him up, when he was working on his book.
I can't remember a story like this before where it's this big a story, and it seems like everyone else has just given up. Like, it's just Gabriel's story.
We talked about in the interview, he talked like 600 people for the book. Roger Ailes not being one of those people who refused to cooperate, so I think it would be hard to, like, get past him on this. So I think other people may be building on it, but he definitely owns the story.
It's interesting when you're covered so doggedly by one person, where you're like, someone like Roger Ailes is like, I would have gotten away from it if it wasn't that damn Sherman. Like, literally, like, there was only one person. Like, if one person would just give up, he would have, like, there would have been no one looking, kind of.
Yeah, there was a quote this morning of Ailes, I don't think it's been confirmed yet, of, you know, rumors of him saying, can't we just rub him out, talking about Gabe Sherman. So wow. We talked about that, about what it's like to pursue someone like that and then have them pursue you.
Good times. How about sponsors?
I don't know, man. You tell me about sponsors.
I'll tell you about a sponsor, MailChimp. They're simply the best way to send emails from your business, from your project, from your house, from your store. Regardless of where you're sending that email from, MailChimp has the tools to make it easy for you. Thank you, MailChimp.
Here's Evan with Gabriel Sherman.
All right. Gabe Sherman, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I am really excited to have you for many reasons, both to just talk about your work, but also because I feel very fortunate to be catching you in this moment, which seems like an extraordinary moment. Does it feel like an extraordinary moment for you?
Yes and no. I mean, still in the middle of it. Yeah. I just came from spending all day reporting, so I sort of haven't had a second to stop and sort of process the coda of my book, which is, you know, Ailes' downfall. But there are moments when it sort of sinks in. I'm like, this is insane that it's ended in a blaze of sexual harassment allegations.
Yeah. I mean, I would say I can think of examples of where, like, reporting really landed in a huge way. But I'm not sure I can think of an example of, like, a bunch of reporting that was done that then, like, a year or 2 years later, like, landed in this kind of way where suddenly it's like, oh, wait, who knows a lot about this? Oh, right, you know everything about this.
Yeah, no, it's satisfying, but also there is a certain part of me that was a little frustrated because when the Gretchen Carlson lawsuit broke at the beginning of July, in many ways I wasn't surprised because my book had multiple examples of sexual harassment by Ailes over the years, and I knew that he was, you know, cross all these lines with women in the workplace. But when my book came out, it never really caught on. I mean, there was kind of bits and pieces of it reported. But there's always, you know, with certain stories, a window when the public is ready to kind of pay attention.
So. Right, yeah. Okay, so let's not get too far ahead of people because probably a lot of people know, but some might not. So I want to start with the book. You wrote a book about Roger Ailes is the thing that people should know if they don't know that already. Roger Ailes has recently resigned slash was forced out of Fox News, which he basically invented and was the impresario of. And now there's just, if you'll excuse the expression, crazy shit happening every day that's coming out in your reporting. And now other people are also reporting it. So, but I wanted to go back and figure out how you got all this stuff, because I just finished reading the book. I hadn't read it previously, and it's also really fun to read it now. People should go buy it and read it right now, because now it's like, it just feels like you're reading something that's like predicting the future. But I know that you were reporting on the media for a while, but tell me how you first got interested in ales.
So yes, I've covered the media business on and off for more than 10 years now. And the genesis of the book was that I had written a series of New York Magazine features where I'm a staff writer for New York. And I had written pieces for the magazine about cable news, sort of around ales. I'd written a piece about CNN. I'd written a profile of Rupert Murdoch. I'd done a big piece about Sarah Palin after the 08 campaign when she was reinventing herself as a right-wing celebrity.
And were these things that you, did you come up with it? Were these ideas that you chased that were of your
interest?
Yeah,
I mean, there was a mix between me and my editors, but we felt that these were sort of, you know, the right stories to do. And eventually I sort of circled back to Fox, because every story, whether it was CNN sort of failing to keep up with Fox, or Sarah Palin going to Fox, or Rupert Murdoch seeing his family split over being embarrassed about Fox, I felt that the real story, I wasn't going at the real story, which is just to do Fox itself. So I talked to my book agent, and she was saying that there had never been a real serious reported book about Fox News.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there had been kind of partisan books and sort of quickie books, but there hadn't really been a deeply reported history of the network. And so we sold it to Random House, and I set out to start reporting the book. And very early on, the entire kind of scope of the book changed, because it moved from being a history of Fox from 96 to the present to being a biography of Roger Ailes. And it changed because there was a quote that jumped out at me. Ailes, in one interview years ago, said, "I built this network from my life experience." And it just lodged in my head. And I said, well, if I'm going to understand Fox News and how it's divided and been such a polarizing influence on American politics, I have to understand where it comes from. And where it comes from is out of his mind and his biography, which goes back to middle of the last century in the industrial Midwest in Ohio, and sort of everything we see now with Trump and this kind of white nationalist backlash is part of that. It's this sense of that the culture is leaving people behind. And so that's why I made it more of a biography, because you see so much of Ailes in the politics of Fox, and that's how it happened.
And when you decided to do that, or when you started moving in that direction, did you think or assume that he would cooperate with that? Or were you going in thinking, I'm going to do this whether or not he... I mean, even if it was a book about Fox, it seems like whether or not Ailes cooperated was going to be a big question.
Well, almost every reporting assignment, I set out to do it either way. I mean, you always want access as a reporter, but you don't want to be limited by access, because I find, especially now in the age where everyone is so flacked and there's so many layers of PR people around, you know, especially powerful people, you got to just be willing to do it whether they cooperate or not. And that was what I said to Ailes and his team. I said, this book's happening. I want you to participate. I want your point of view, but I'm not willing to make... They tried to make all kinds of deals with me. Well, you can't quote this person, or, you know, you need to do this, and then we'll do an interview. I said, well, no, I'm not going to, like, make preconditions on my reporting based on whether you might give me an interview. And so that just got thrown out the window, and I set out. And I kept hoping he was going to cooperate. I would send him letters. I would talk to his advisors. But by the end, I realized that there was, you know, no hope, because he was so paranoid and sort of tied up in knots about the book. But the last thing I'll say is, in a lot of ways, I felt the book benefited by not having Ailes have any kind of control over it, because one of the things he's such a genius at is spinning and fabricating narratives that, if you watch Fox, don't necessarily have a lot to do with reality.
Yeah.
And he's done that with reporters through the years. And I did not want to be allow him to kind of shape. I wanted to be in control of the story, not him.
Yeah. Well, then a crazy thing happened, which I was reading. It's either in the source notes of the book, but I was reading about elsewhere, that while your book was going on, he, like, arranged for an authorized biography to happen basically to try and either counterbalance, or do you feel like it was to beat yours out and try to get
so
rid of
it? This is to the point about him trying to control the narrative. About a year into my reporting, when it became very clear that I wasn't going to stop and my book was happening, he quickly commissioned a fake authorized biography that my sources said he actually had control over the copy and edited it himself. I've even heard he paid the writer under the table to do it, in addition to his book advance. He basically rushed this book out into bookstores as a way of preempting mine. And when I first heard that he was doing this, I sort of freaked out because I said, oh, well, you know, what if this is an amazing book and it comes out a year before mine? But then I realized that, well, it can't be. I mean, he's not, the whole point of this is PR, not journalism. And so the book itself is a total whitewashed account of his life. And obviously none of the allegations we're learning about over the last few weeks, you know, are involved in that book at all.
Right. It would be very surprising to go back to that book and be, oh, actually, it's all here.
It's all here.
Well, how did you, so let's talk about how you tackled this problem of not having his cooperation. And I assume, I mean, from reading the book and from now seeing more about him that you're reporting on, you know, he's paranoid. He's also controlled Fox. Like, people answered to him and were loyal to him. Can you describe sort of your process for getting in to talk to people, getting people to give you anything?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. And it's funny, as a reporter, I don't often think about the craft of reporting. It's just, you know, it's my job. But I've thought about actually how I did the book as a way of sort of in the future how I would approach reporting challenges. I'd say two things. So I thought about the world of Fox News and Roger Ailes as sort of concentric circles. So when I started the reporting for the book, I sort of focused on the outermost circle, former employees, longtime friends of his, people who don't have day-to-day connections with the network.
Mm-hmm.
And I focused my reporting on those people, and especially his childhood. I took a reporting trip to Ohio. I got documents from his parents' divorce records, people who've known long in the past. And then with that base of knowledge, I started to move in the circle, people who worked with him, you know, in the 70s, in the 80s. And then, and by the time I was really doing a lot of my focusing on the recent years at Fox, I had such a base of knowledge about him, and I was so authoritative on Ailes, I could speak with sources on a level where they would trust me, that I wasn't just parachuting into a story.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one approach. The other thing is, I really appealed to people who worked with Ailes, because it's true, even though he's paranoid and, you know, been, I think, a divisive influence on America, he is a genius. And people who've worked with him, you know, they sort of feel that they saw something. They had a front row seat to this American icon that they wanted to document, that, you know, so much of the coverage of Fox is so partisan. No one really had set out to try to just document this as history.
Uh-huh.
And so that was my kind of high-minded approach to subjects. Like, I'm just trying to understand this, and so we have a record of it. And I was actually surprised that sources who wanted, they, you know, once they got over the fear of talking, they actually wanted to share stories about working with Ailes, because he is such a sui generis figure, and he's so fascinating. That got people to open up.
Mm-hmm. And his brother, did his brother talk to you?
Yeah, his brother Robert Ailes talked to me at length multiple times in long phone interviews. And I was very surprised at. I think I first reached out to him when I was in Ohio on a reporting trip. He lives down in Florida. He's a doctor. And I was expecting him just to, you know, hang up the phone. And we struck up a rapport, and I followed up after that. We had several long phone interviews. And he illuminated a lot of what I had learned in the divorce records that of Ailes' parents, who his dad was a very, according to the documents, very sort of violent, sadistic guy. And Robert confirmed all of this about their childhood being this very, his father just would fly into a rage. And so I think, again, he wanted to, I think, talk to a writer who was trying to, you know, show his brother as a kind of a world historical figure.
Yeah, I guess almost documenting the family.
Yeah,
important
brother,
in American history.
Yeah, and his brother was kind of the family genealogist. I mean, he's a really, really thoughtful person. And he had sort of put together an unpublished family history / autobiography. So he was such a great resource, because we trace, in the book, I trace Ailes's family all the way back to when they came to the States in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. So his brother really helped me with the genealogy.
How'd you learn how to do this kind of reporting? Like, I had breakfast with someone who was a very small part of a story you did years ago, and I won't say who it is, but I mentioned that I was talking to you, and he said, oh, yeah, I was in a speed reported story, and I was in it a little bit. He's a killer. Mm-hmm. He's a killer, man. But he meant it in the most, he's a reporter, so he meant it in the most complimentary possible way. Yeah. But I'm curious where your reporting skills developed.
Well, it's funny, just before this, we were talking about the New York Observer, and that it kind of all goes back to that, because my mentor was Peter Kaplan, the late editor of the paper, who I showed up there when I was, like, 22 or 23 years old. And, you know, he just throws you into it. I didn't go to journalism school, so I, you know, learned by doing. And I think my first full-time job was writing the weekly real estate column, where you try to, you know, report and find out the biggest sale of the week, and you're competing against the New York Post and the New York Times. And so I just got obsessed with wanting to break the biggest apartment sale of the week, which I knew nothing about real estate. I was living, I think, with a college friend in like a shitty apartment. So like, it was hilarious that I was like writing about $20 million deals. But both the pressure of having to produce a scoop every week and the discipline of having to just pick up the phone and cold call real estate brokers. Like, it was basically like telemarketing.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, in my personal life, I'm a total introvert. Like, my wife and I, if we go to a cocktail party, like, I'm just like sitting by the wall. Like, I don't schmooze and mingle. But there, when I work, when I'm reporting, I'll just call or talk to anybody because it's work. And so I got over my fear of talking to people. And, you know, I would make 20 phone calls a day if I had to get, or you hear a tip and then you call five people and they hang up on you. And then you know, so like, it's just that discipline, I think, of that's where I learned to do that kind of work that paid off with the Ailes book.
Do you retain your interest in the biggest apartment sale of the?
Well, now it's just voyeurism. And I just like, I read the Times real estate section. I just get pissed off that I'll never. I'm old enough now where I know my lot in life, and I'm just never going to get there. So
I imagine you calling on weekends. I'm still trying to get. Yeah. I just like to know it. I know, like, the biggest one. It's just part of what I do. So Peter Kaplan, The Observer, and then did you go from there to New York Magazine?
No, so I did a brief. My transition to magazine writing is I joined the short-lived business magazine Portfolio.
Oh, yeah, Portfolio.
And so I was there for about a year or so. But that was my first job where I wrote a handful of 3,000 or 4,000 word pieces. Because The Observer, none of my stories were longer than, say, 1,500 words or so. So that was a big learning experience for me, because I learned how to take the reporting I did, but then tell a story. Because mm-hmm. I remember my first draft of a magazine feature I did. I think my paragraphs are like 3 sentences long. They were just like clipped and totally clueless about how to write a magazine story. So, and then from there, I ended up in New York.
And it always strikes me as a interesting thing covering the media. You are inherently covering the thing that you are of. And did you have an interest? Did you gravitate towards that because it was something that you think is an interesting subject matter, or that you thought you were really good at?
No, I gravitated towards it because when I was at The Observer, the best beats were either media or politics. And there was an opening on the media beat. I had been doing real estate for over a year or so, and then there was an opening on the media beat. And so I told Peter I wanted that job. And just from there, I developed an interest of it. And then since then, I think I've continued to cover it because I live in New York City. And I've always said, you know, if you live in a place, you want to write about the thing that is in that place. So if you live in L.A. and you're a journalist, you probably want to write about Hollywood. Or if you're in San Francisco, tech. Well, so in, you know, New York, it's either finance, media, I guess fashion, or, you know, or politics. And so, like, you know, media is just our backyard. So that's just why, as a beat, I think it's fun to cover because it's so central to how the city works.
When you cover this stuff, do you feel like, I don't know the right way to say this, is going to sound stupid the way I'm going to say it, but powerful is the word I was going to use, but like that you can affect what happens in the media through your reporting, that you can, I mean, we'll get back to Ailes in a second where there's a sort of specific application of that, but like, reporting on Gawker, reporting on, you know, do you feel like people are wary of you because you hold power over their jobs in some way?
I guess I don't think of it in those sort of specific terms because I actually don't think of media as any different than any other. Like, I've covered for New York Magazine. I've written big pieces about Wall Street.
Right.
My first cover story was about the Horace Mann School when they were going through a big scandal with their board of directors. So I just think of media as an institution. And I sort of apply that lens of how just trying to explain how a powerful institution works and just happens to be either, you know, in Fox's case, a news network or the New York Times as a newspaper. But I would report on it the same way as I was reporting on, say, like Goldman Sachs. It's just,
yeah,
there, you know, because in a certain way, the difference is banks and other big companies are opaque because that's what corporations are. You know, media is supposed to be transparent. But as we all know, media companies are no different than any other company.
Non-transparent, yeah, and probably more thin-skinned.
Yeah, and the people who work there actually know how journalism works. So they're, you know, they can be more manipulative.
Hey, Aaron, let's put these guys on hold for a second and tell the listeners a little bit about our friends at Audible.
Well, the first thing I'd point out is they have over 250,000 audiobook titles. That is more than anyone in the universe.
They also got more than just book titles. They've got podcasts now. They're making original podcasts, and they're good.
Yeah, I like, they've got one about the U.S. presidents. That I've been enjoying that one.
Yeah.
And another thing I've been enjoying is listening to the people who've been on this show. Like, I've already heard their voice. Now I want to hear their writing read aloud.
Cheryl Strayed.
Malcolm Gladwell. I believe they've got Gabriel Sherman, the book about Roger Ailes.
Yeah, if you haven't read it yet, you can go listen to it. You don't even have to read it.
So if I wanted to sign up for Audible, how would I do it?
You would go to audible.com/longform. That's audible.com/longform. And if you did that, you would get a 30-day free trial and a free book of your choice.
And you'd be supporting the show. Thank you, Audible. Here is Evan back with Gabriel Sherman.
This is a crazy moment because things that you've covered are sort of like all, not just the Ailes thing, but you did a profile of Jared Kushner.
Mm-hmm.
Even he wasn't even married to Ivanka Trump at the time.
They got engaged, I think, like a week or two after my story ran, which when you asked about affecting things, I have no idea if it was timed, but it's a coincidence.
But that's obviously now landing in this huge
way.
Well,
and Trump, right? Like, so
and Trump himself.
Yeah, like when I was on the real estate beat, you know, Trump was great because I was like 23 and clueless, and he would get on the phone with me. Like, and you're 23 years old, and you're like, "Hey, mom, dad, like Donald Trump just did an interview with me," and like now the guy is doing the same thing, but he's running for president. Like, it's that this whole last year has been, yeah, kind of surreal because I did a Trump cover story for New York, and Jared was a character in that story, and Ailes was a character. It's just like everything is coming together.
Yeah. Or even in a different way, you profiled A.J. Delario.
Yeah.
And then that. All,
oh, yeah. That
for, you know, when he was,
yeah,
just a Deadspin.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah,
the Gawker thing all blew up. I feel like you've seen the future, yeah, and planted little media minds that are now blowing up somehow or something. Back to the Ailes book. How long did you work on that book for?
It was like 3 years start to finish.
So there's a note in the source notes that says you talked to over 600 people, which I was like, oh, that's a lot of people, but it's a book. You probably worked on it a long time. And then I looked at this Roger Goodell profile that you did for GQ, and it says you talked to over 100 people just for a magazine profile, which is, I think, a lot.
Yeah, that was... Oh, so the Goodell piece was similar to the Ailes. NFL and Fox actually are very similar in how they are set up, in that they're very wary of outsiders. It's paranoid. It's powerful. They expect to run the world, so they don't like when reporters ask questions. But yeah, with the Goodell piece, same thing. Like, I got very little access, and I had to tell this story. And so the only way to do that was just to completely surround it and just talk to everyone I could. And I think that also sort of really drove the news cycle, because my story was the first to report that him and Patriots owner Robert Kraft were like this.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a quote in my story. And I should preface all this to say, like, I'm not a football fan at all. I mean, I'll watch it, but I came to that story, like, just as a journalist, not as someone who...
Just in the institution of,
yeah,
the NFL.
Like, I wasn't partisan to any of the teams. And I quoted one of the NFL executives saying that the nickname for Kraft in the league is the assistant commissioner. And then when Deflategate happened, one of the players, I think it was for the Seahawks, used that quote. He said, oh, you know, Bob Kraft is the assistant commissioner. It just went totally viral. And so it was just, it was, you know, as an outsider, fascinating to see that this, like, magazine story was then becoming like the central narrative of the Super Bowl.
Did you get like blowback from people thinking that you were partisan? Like
No, but it was funny because I got invited to go on like sports talk radio and sport. And I just, you know, I like sports, but I'm not like a super fan. So,
So the thing I was going to ask before is when you're doing something like writing this book about ales, ales won't talk to you. You're spending 3 years on it. That person looms so large in your life, like is arguably like an obsession of yours. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, like, how does that feel to have someone who is that kind of presence in your life that you also don't talk to?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good, I think obsession's it's a good word. I mean, the reason I knew it was a book is that every day I woke up as interested, if not more so, in the subject than the day before. And he's just so fascinating as a human being and as a part of the American scene. You know, if you look at his life, you know, he worked for Nixon in 68, you know, running his television campaign and basically giving him a makeover for television. He ran George H.W. Bush's campaign in 88. A lot of people think that his style of politics is what gave us the Willie Horton ad. You know, he created Fox. I mean, he's one of these people that has fundamentally changed America, and yet he's never really been studied before and written about before in that kind of way. And so I felt like I was, part of the obsession was that I felt like I was off on, you know, in unexplored terrain. Mm. And I was in this story that felt so uniquely my own. And I felt like almost, I didn't need to sit down with him because he has so little capacity for self-reflection. I mean, his job, he's made hundreds of millions of dollars basically spinning. And so when you sit down with a subject, you want them to really engage with you. He never would, I doubt he would ever really engage with a writer in that way. So having him kind of at that distance allowed me just to kind of see him for who he was.
Now, in the book, there are at least two, I think, incidents that are similar to the incidents that have come out in this Gretchen Carlson lawsuit and mm-hmm. subsequent. Like, there's definitely like a woman who comes in for a job and there's a like clear like yeah. sexual favors type offer. Mm-hmm. And that's in your book. Like, that's out. And were you surprised that that didn't get picked up or go anywhere? Or did it get picked up by people at the time?
It got picked up a little bit. She's a very brave woman. Her name is Randy Harrison. She lives in the East Village. And she had worked at NBC in the 80s as a young producer. And Ailes, yes, as I reported, propositioned her. He said he would give her a raise in exchange for sex.
Right.
And I was really, you know, Random House, my publisher, and myself, like, this is, you know, that was explosive to be able to say that. And I remember thinking, like, this is going to really shake things up. And when the book came out, it did, you know, it got picked up on a few blogs, but then it kind of went away. And so, yeah, when this whole thing exploded, I wasn't surprised. There was many other examples that weren't in the book just for various reasons that, you know, whether the person wouldn't go on the record or whatever. But I knew this whole pattern existed going
yeah.
all the way back to the 1960s. So it wasn't surprising at all.
And it seems like, I mean, in a way, it's sort of like a microcosm of what happens in many workplaces, like something gets swept under the rug.
Yeah.
But it also, I mean, it seems doubly insane that it could appear in a book published by Random House that's like on the bestseller list
yeah.
that this person engages in this behavior and like you would hear nothing from their employer or there would be no seeming consequences
yeah.
of that.
Well, that's, you know, that's the Murdoch way, is as we saw in London with the phone hacking, and we're seeing to some degree here. His whole MO is like, don't ask questions and only fire someone or push them out if it becomes a major scandal. So one little, you know, a book coming out is not going to cause Rupert Murdoch to be, okay, Roger Ailes, this isn't the values I want for my company.
And so after it came out and you did the publicity around it, and did you at that point think, okay, I will now have a you know, another 10 years of covering Roger Ailes as the Fox News person, you know, that you would keep covering him? And was there any sense that there was something unstable underneath waiting to erupt?
Yes and no. So when my book was published in 2014, coincided with like his first of his major health setbacks. So he's taken extended leaves of absence from Fox over the last couple of years with various back surgery. And he has, as I write in the book, he's a hemophiliac, and a side effect of hemophilia is that it ravages your joints because your blood, when you get bruises in your joints and then you get arthritis. So he's had a lot of surgeries through the years. And I knew that his health was really bad. So I was thinking, oh, well, maybe he's just going to have to step down. And I always thought the thing that was going to bring him down was not sex. It was somehow, you know, we would really finally learn about how he was scripting talking points for, you know, Republicans. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I thought it was going to be something political that was going to bring him down, not sex. But actually, it makes sense. The reason why he's being brought down by this isn't about partisan politics. This is about sort of human decency. And even if Republicans are kind of outraged by when they're reading this.
And when so you mentioned the Carlson lawsuit, was that something you were aware of before that came out?
Yes and no. I mean, I knew that she was, I didn't know about the sexual harassment with her specifically. I knew that she was on the outs with Ailes. But the actual filing of the suit was a surprise. And I was in France over the 4th of July on vacation. And we landed at JFK on July 6th. It was a Wednesday, I believe. And I remember turning on my phone when I got off the plane and just started lighting up with text messages because she had filed the lawsuit like a few hours before. And so from like that day, and I was totally jet lagged from that day on, I was just, you know, reporting the story around the clock. But I'm so glad it was like that day and not the first day of my vacation, because I would have like been freaking out, have to like leave France to come back.
And I don't do this kind of beat reporting. So I am curious, even after the book came out, at what level are you ambiently engaged with, obviously now you're reporting, you're really reporting all the time, but previous to that, you know, checking in with people from Fox News once in a while, like what's your sort of like daily routine with that stuff like?
That's a good question. After the book kind of wound down, I moved on to other pieces. So I wasn't fully engaged, but as the 2016 presidential race ramped up, I sort of re-engaged because, you know, Fox is so intertwined with the Republican Party that I sort of wanted to, you know, reconnect with those sources. And you don't ever fully disengage. I mean, you know, I spent 3 years in this world, so I, you know, these are people I am now just sort of corresponding with regularly. But it definitely picked up starting in 2015. I took a year kind of away from the book.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it seemed like as the Trump phenomenon sort of gained steam, it was a weird thing for Fox. I mean, I'm a listener to right-wing talk radio. It's like a weird habit that
Who's
I have.
Who's your go-to, Rush? Or...
Well, I used to love the kind of like B and C level ones, like the Laura Ingrams of the world.
Yeah.
But now I'll listen to Rush and Sean Hannity sometimes.
Well, yeah, they're fully on it. Because like Mark Levin is totally not on the
Trump
train.
Against. Yeah. And Beck, Beck was against. Yeah. But Limbaugh kind of like, he was treading a lot. He was like...
Cruz a little bit.
Yeah. And then he kind of tipped over and hit, and he's just...
it's like part of the Trump campaign at
this point. Yeah, basically. But when I was reading your book, there's a crazy line in there where someone says, this guy Podell recognized, quote, a lot of latent Donald Trump in Roger Ailes. Mm-hmm. Like, there's this kind of like, they're sort of similar figures in some way. And again, it seemed like... a crazy moment for these things to be coming together and having to interact.
Yeah, a friend of mine jokes that there's like this strand of Republican guys. We joke that they're like the Reyes caucus because it's like Rush Limbaugh, Roger Ailes, Rudy Giuliani, you know, like I guess Bo Diddle is private eye. These guys, they're like kind of New York media guy. I mean, Rush is in Florida, but like they're these like tough guys, but they're Republicans. And like Trump is one of them too. And it is Trump and Ailes go way back. They talk all the time. Ailes is advising him on the campaign. There's like so many speeches I've heard Trump give where I'll get an email from a Fox guy and he'll be like, well, you know, those clearly was Roger's talking points. So, yeah, when Trump probably started gaining steam, one of the reasons I took Trump seriously is because I could see that he was tapping that same style of politics that had built Fox into and also talk radio into such a phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. And so then after this lawsuit against Ailes broke, then you did a number of stories about other people who were now coming forward or on the verge of coming forward with their own sexual harassment accusations against him. And were those people that came to you because they knew you were on this, or did you already have people that you sort of thought, I should get in touch with this person?
So the first round of stories, like right after the lawsuit, they had some of those women had reached out to Gretchen Carlson's lawyer.
Uh-huh.
And the lawyer I had been in touch with because I was covering the suit, because I had covered this in my book and I was not new to the subject, she steered the women to me. And so then I interviewed those women, and then I was put in touch with other women. And then since then, I've had more women contact me, and I've interviewed more than 20 women, many of them on the record, who have told accounts of being sexually harassed by Ailes. And I'm just like one reporter. So that means there must be, you know, well over 100 out there or more. And so when people, I've seen people, you know, have headlines that say like Ailes is the Cosby of media, it doesn't surprise me that there is at least 100 to 200 women out there who have been sexually harassed by him.
That is insane.
Which is, it's insane. But then the other thing I really wrestle with is this guy has been famous, powerful, in the public eye for 30, 40 years, and yet none of this stuff really came out. Like, these women were living with this kind of secret while this guy was affecting world affairs. You would think that he was so public, wouldn't some woman come forward? But because this culture of fear that he wields, I go back and forth. I mean, sometimes I think I'm surprised that women didn't come forward earlier. But then other times I think, well, he's, you know, what's in it for them? There's no upside. They don't want to, you know, it's terrifying to come forward. So.
Yeah. And he wasn't just a sort of powerful person. It seems like he explicitly threatened people, threatened their careers,
oh, yeah.
said, you
yeah.
will regret this if you ever.
Well, and the really chilling example of that is the story of Lori Loon, which I wrote for New York Magazine, who was in this kind of psychological tormented relationship with him for 20 years. And he, in their first sexual encounter, when he brought her to a hotel room, he videotaped her. And when she asked what he was going to do with it, he said, I'm putting it into a safety deposit box just so we understand each other. So that was explicitly blackmail, that if she ever said something, he would, like, presumably leak this video. I mean, that's a sick, sadistic thing to do. But that's what he would do to women when he would say, if you ever say anything about this, I'll get you.
And how are you managing these, like, reporting relationships with people who are putting their lives on the line to, in some cases, on the record yeah. by name, come out and talk about this?
Yeah, it's, I don't write about, this is really actually the first experience in my journalism career where I've written about real sort of victims. A lot of the stuff I've written about is business, politics, media. And so there's, you know, these are all, you know, powerful people. This is the real story where I'm writing about people that have been taken advantage of by a powerful person. And I remember it really hit me when I was flying home from the Republican convention. I was flying home from Cleveland, and I was like going on no sleep. And I had written a series of stories about women who had come forward. And I remember it's like collapsing into the airplane seat. And I remember just like tears were just like streaming down my face. I was like both out of exhaustion, but just it finally hit me about these women who had, it had taken so much courage to break their silence. These women were saying, like, I have to say something, but I don't know what's going to happen to me. And that was the moment where it hit me that this was real life. This wasn't just a story. These were people who were taking kind of a big risk by speaking out.
And some of them had signed settlement agreements and
yeah.
things like that. That
yeah, they could have. I had one woman, this was a really chilling anecdote, where she told me she was going to talk to me, but she had to transfer all of her assets to her mother's bank account. So she literally went to the bank, moved all of her money to her mother's savings account, and only then would she talk to me, because if Fox sued her, you know, she wouldn't have the money, you know, it would be in her mom's name. And so it's like when people talk about that kind of stuff, you realize, like, shit, like, they're putting a lot of faith in you. And I don't want to be responsible for, you know, them being, but they're making that decision, and you have to honor their decision to speak up. But it's a lot, it weighs on you.
Yeah. And other people had to know. Like, Ailes has gotten forced out, right? But I assume this is the reporting you're doing
yeah.
now.
Yeah,
but it seemed from a logical, unreported perspective, there's no fucking way that people didn't know
yeah.
that this was happening.
Yeah, so that's been a line of reporting I've been really pursuing over the last week or so, which is to try to really show that this was a culture that people knew about and more so enabled, because it's one thing to know, it's another thing to help make it happen. And I reported in that story about Lori Loon, the booker who had 20 years of harassment, Diane Brandy, the Fox News' general counsel, signed, and I viewed the document, she signed a $3 million settlement with her. And she went to Ailes and said, well, what's this allegation? He denied it and said, settle. Well, if you work at a company and some employee comes to you and says, I've been harassed by the CEO for 20 years, and you just take his word, I mean, that should have launched a major HR investigation, like outside lawyers, like nothing happened. Like they just signed $3 million check and she went away. So that's an example where, you know, the lawyer, the head lawyer of Fox News knew about this in at least one instance and did nothing.
Yeah. And there's also been a, as a like follower of Fox News and talk radio, there was like a wave of all these people who work for the network coming out and defending Ailes, yeah, and then suddenly then nothing.
Yeah. You know, there was like this PR campaign that he waged in the days after Carlson's lawsuit where he rallied, especially female employees to defend him. And not one of them, except Greta Van Susteren, has slowly walked back some of the things she said, has come forward. I mean, to me, that if you're going to own those words, you should now come out and either defend them or disown them.
Yeah. One of the things that really struck me was that the, I can't remember the woman's name, but the one who's still at Fox, but has kind of been sidelined, but just, you just reported that.
Andrea Tanteros.
Yeah.
Yes.
She, in your like kind of, and not the epilogue, but a note on sources in your book, you talk about she was one of the people that came out and criticized your like reporting of the book.
Yeah.
And I believed used the word harasser.
Harasser, yeah. Well, and Ailes said that to me. That was language he used too. I remember I saw him at a party at the Four Seasons, and I went up to him to interview him at a public event, and he called me a harasser. And I think that word, reflecting on it, my wife and I were talking about this, it's so interesting because it's almost a form of projection. I mean, why would you call a reporter, you could say you're a pest or you're a pain in the ass, get out of my way. But he said, like, you're a harasser. And I think now it's probably because he, you know, he knew deep down that he is a harasser and he was just like projecting that.
Well, yeah. And also, I mean, it puts in a different light. It's one thing for him to be private and paranoid and not want you to report the book.
Yeah.
But it's another thing to then realize that there were 100 people's worth of secrets that were just lying in wait. And
yeah,
you found some of them. But that's, I mean, he had that to worry about.
Yeah. And that's why he, around the time I started working on the book, he created what was called the Black Room at Fox, which was this, basically this intelligence office that he had people smearing my reputation online. He had private investigators following me. It was basically this dirty tricks operation that he set up because of my book. And now it all makes sense. Like, you would only go to those lengths to be so paranoid if you really had secrets that you didn't want the world to know about.
Did you perceive being followed at the time?
So I never did. But so my wife and I moved to Vermont for the summer of 2012 to work, to write. I was writing the book and she was editing the manuscript, and she saw a black SUV parked on the dirt road, like right next to the house we were staying at. And it, you know, we were in the middle of Vermont. Like, there's no reason for a black Suburban to be up there. So that was the closest we came to actually seeing PIs.
That seems, yeah, both, sounds like it was probably them. And also like, what a goofball operation.
Yeah.
Like, why couldn't they get like a more beat up rental car,
yeah,
well, that would stand out so much?
What we also joked about is like, I'm like the most boring dude. Like, we would like work, cook dinner, and watch Breaking Bad. Like, so I pitied these like private eyes who like, there's no strip clubs or like coke habits or gambling debts. Like, there's nothing that they would latch on to.
Do you think you could get the file? Like, it would be,
I would love
to
my
get
dossier.
Their file.
I know. It's like, maybe it's like, it'll be like, you know, the Stasi files eventually will all just come out.
And there was also some gawker people, John Cook.
Yeah. So yeah, he would do this. Followed. Yeah. Not only to me, but yeah, he would have PIs, you know, try to dig up dirt on journalists. Yeah. And Cook and Hamilton at Gawker.
That's just, and this was paid for by Fox money.
That's what, to me, again, it's to your question about who else knew. That's where it moves out of the realm of kind of being, you know, eccentric and paranoid to being kind of an abuse of corporate power. I mean, he's using company shareholder resources to wage a personal dirty tricks campaign against people he doesn't like. And
like rural Vermont.
Yeah. And that is, but that was the culture of Fox, that he could run the company as almost like a mom and pop shop, even though it's part of a global conglomerate.
And you mentioned also organizing people to sort of smear your name or, you know, put out things about you online. Is that something, because you report on Fox, that you experience on a regular basis? Like, do you feel like you're in a maelstrom of sort of like the craziness that has now accompanied the election, Trump,
yeah,
supporters, like all that,
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, it's definitely died down. There was a period more before the book came out where I was turned into a target. Like there was websites that called me a Soros puppet. Ailes was pushing this conspiracy theory that George Soros was paying me to write the book. I've never met Soros in my life. If he was paying me, I got a really bad deal because, like, we live up in Queens. Like, I clearly didn't demand a bigger deal from him. So there was a time where, like, we got death threat at home. Like, some crank called and, you know, said, "We're going to come after you. You're coming after the right. We're going to get you." Like, that was scary because, again, like, it's not just, like, you don't know if it's just a crank. Like, you, when you have, like, right-wing websites that are turning you into a target, you know, it's one thing if they do it with, like, a politician. They have, like, you know, security or handlers. Like, I don't have any of that. So
did you do anything?
I did look into getting our apartment swept for bugs because I had heard rumors that he was, like, tapping my phone. But it would have cost, I think the estimate we got was, like, $10,000 to have my home office swept. I don't have that. So we never did. But, like, that's the mentality when you're in this paranoid bubble. You think anything is possible.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that was entirely possible.
Yeah, it wasn't paranoid. It was real. Yeah.
So now, do you feel like you're on some kind of 24/7 beat with this? Or what happens next?
Yeah. So I want to ride out the story some more because I think the questions that I want to be fully answered are who else knew about this? And also the... you know, were any corporate rules broken? And then also what happens next, right? Because Fox has been, you know, been such a driving force on the right for 20 years. And now with James and Lachlan Murdoch moving into positions, leadership positions at 21st Century Fox, the parent company, their politics are very different than their father's. So what is the post-Ailes Fox? That's a good story. But then, I would like to move on. I want to, my agent's been after me to come up with another book idea. So I do, in theory, want to move on.
I mean, it's hard to move on when this much is happening and a lot of it.
Yeah, like right now, yeah.
Yeah, in the middle of the election also. How does it work at New York Magazine for you? Do you set your own kind of agenda in terms of, you know, you write for the web, you write for the magazine? Like, how does that all that get organized?
Yeah, so New York's great. It's really been my home, journalistic home, for 7-8 years now. What I love about it is Adam has, everyone talks about, you know, print and digital, but he's figured out how to, Adam Moss, the editor of the magazine, how to use the website to kind of amplify the print magazine and vice versa. So I'll oftentimes do a whole body of reporting for the website that will then grow into a print feature. So, you know, that may happen in the Ailes case. I'm not sure. I've been doing a mix. My last cover story was on the Trump campaign. I traveled with them. So, you know, it's great. You can write 6,000 words in print or you can break news on the web. You can sort of play in different fields.
And did Trump remember you from your like early reporting?
I don't think so. I doubt it, but he... you know, when I brought up the Observer, I mean, he knows the paper. I mean, of course, with Jared, who owns it, yeah.
So sort of, yeah, as a connection to dictating what it says, almost, you could say. And are you, when you say you're looking to do the next thing, do you have interest in moving away from, like, business and media? Like, do you feel like you get satiated when it comes to that, or that you, there's more you'd like to do with it?
Well, I think the lens that I look at a story, I think it first has to be about the person or the subject. So, like, Fox was this mysterious, opaque kind of quasi-cult that, you know, no one really knew how it worked. So that was the interest for me. And then, you know, my next story, whether it's... I think it has to be something where I just, inherently, I have that obsession about what it is. So I don't know. It doesn't have to be business or media. I think it has to either be a world that I want to try to get into or a person I want to understand.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
We mostly talk journalism and process on the show. We rarely just talk political opinions, but because you have such a deep knowledge of both this media institution, in particular Fox, but the way the media has gone in general and politics, what do you think is going to happen? I'm not asking like who's going to win the election, but I mean, it feels like we're at a place where we can't go back to the way things were before. That this is a watershed moment, both like what's happening with Fox,
yeah,
something's got to change. And like just Trump's campaign, whether he wins or loses, like we can't go back to the pre like 2014 era.
Yeah, I think there's some there's definitely something to that. I think the for the last 20 years, sort of Ailes's power was such that he sort of took over the Republican Party. And what's so interesting is that since 2008, the Republicans have lost every presidential election. So so while Republicans sort of bowed down to him and to his agenda, kind of his paranoid right-wing agenda, it didn't win them elections. And now if Trump, if you look at the poll numbers, it looks like he's going down in flames. If they lose again, and now with Ailes being deposed from Fox, like you could really imagine Republicans saying, listen, we've tried this now three or four times. It hasn't worked, and we are going to reconstitute ourselves as a different. I think there could really be a diminution of the power of right-wing media and talk radio, because you see the party elites like Paul Ryan, they're sick of like cowing to people that they know are never going to appeal to the middle of this country.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that I could be completely wrong, but I could just imagine a scenario where the sort of moderate Republicans formally split off from this kind of angry populist base. And I don't know if that means like formally the party splits or that they just, you know, are refusing to like, you know, so many Republicans just would go on Fox and participate in things that they in private would know are ridiculous, like the show Fox and Friends. I remember in the 2012 election, Mitt Romney gave, I'm going to get it wrong, but he gave, you know, dozens of interviews to Fox and Friends. You know, and Mitt Romney, whatever you think about his politics, like he's a thoughtful guy, and yet he's having to kind of lower himself to being on that morning show. And I think now I could see Republicans saying, listen, this is not, Fox News is not going to help us win elections.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, that's why I'm fascinated by listening to talk radio, yeah. Is that having listened to Hannity and Limbaugh and those type of people for decades, like what Trump is saying is just distilled from that, which is an entertainment product. And it's being distilled into like a political campaign.
Yeah.
It's an entertainment product that you may hate and is disgusting in its own ways, but it's not, it was never intended to actually be a political platform of any type.
And there's no like actual policy.
There's nothing there.
Yeah, exactly. And so if he goes down in flames, I could see the party saying we can't let the entertainment wing of our party dictate how we run campaigns.
And do you think, I mean, it was interesting reading the book and you're talking about the origins of Fox News and the origins of the slogan of fair and balanced and all the things that were said around that when it launched. Mm-hmm. And Jim Rutenberg wrote this column the other day about the way reporters approach Trump. I think it was him in the Times, and how objective can you be in this type of scenario? And do you think your politics, like you don't show up in a huge way in most of your stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, there might be a little like he told me, she told me kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What role do you think your own personal politics play in this type of reporting that you've done?
Well, I guess, I mean, it's impossible to devoid your politics from your writing because it's disingenuous. But I think what I try to do is I try to ask the same questions of a subject, whether I'm writing about a Democrat or a Republican. It's the basics. You know, it's the journalism, who, what, where, when, why, like just to try to report. I was thinking about this after reading Jim's column, you know, this whole debate about, well, how do you describe Trump if you're a reporter? Is it biased if you call him a demagogue? And I actually don't think that's a productive conversation because it's actually more powerful if you're a reporter and you believe Trump is a demagogue, well, go report a story that shows it, you know, show his words or find out inside the campaign, are there like memos that show him wanting to, you know, break constitutional rules? I mean, there are sort of ways you can show him being a demagogue as a reporter that doesn't get you into the realm of opinion. And so I guess that's what I try to do with my politics is, you know, my interest in Ailes wasn't necessarily because he was right wing, it's because he was powerful. And so the same way, if I was going to write about, you know, a liberal megalomaniacal media mogul, it would be the same. I would want to understand them in the same way.
Ted Turner.
Yeah. Well, and I've written about CNN. I've written about, you know, the Sulzberger family. So, I mean, I feel like that's the way I try to approach it. And you know, I hope people can see that, you know, I'm trying to play by the same rules.
Breaking these kinds of stories and doing this kind of work is the kind of reason why a lot of people get into journalism. Is that why you got into journalism? Why did you get into journalism originally?
That's a good question. There wasn't like a one reason. I mean, I think I've always loved writing and current events and reading the paper. And I always just assumed like reporting was journalism. Maybe it's like the way you grew up watching like All the President's Men, like these, you know, Hollywood's idea of reporting. And so, yeah, no, I mean, in many ways, this was the Ailes story was kind of the ultimate story where you have a subject that is so combative and paranoid, and it's so satisfying when you can still tell that story.
And do you feel like there's still a chance that he could be following you and having all that sort of stuff done? Is there still that?
I mean, I think anything's possible, but I think at least right now he's got, you know, bigger, hopefully, luckily for me, I hope he has bigger problems than worrying about me, because, you know, he's facing this lawsuit and potentially more lawsuits, and he was negotiating a severance. I mean, I hope this story is keeping him busy, because I don't want problems in my life.
Well, it's incredible reporting. I'm going to let you get back to it, because I know you have a lot to do. I really appreciate you coming by.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. That's it for this week's Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from The Atavist. Thanks to Gabe Sherman for coming in for this amidst his many reporting calls. I imagine that he got back in the car and made like 20 calls on the way home and discovered 20 more things about Roger Ailes. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. This episode was edited by Janelle Pfeiffer, and our intern is Courtney Harrell. Thanks to them both. And as always, thanks to our sponsors, MailChimp and Audible, who make this podcast possible. We'll see you next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon, taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.